This is an ABC podcast.
Good Bulla Friday morning. Good morning. This is Belinda Cora and I'm delighted to present this morning's second Pacific Beat Show from the ABC House in Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea. Thank you for joining me on Pacific Beat here on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, a new bridge project designed to connect people in Tonga drives them further apart.
We'll have people coming in and out that we don't know. There'll be vehicles we're unfamiliar with and not knowing if they're genuinely passing by or for something else.
And the Solomon Islands chase a history-making win at the OFC Women's Nations Cup. Pacific Beat comes to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Let's get started. But first, at the start of the week on Pacific Beat, we heard from the Catholic Bishop of Mendi, Don Lippitt, who voiced his concerns about the lack of political will to tackle the scourge of sorcery accusation-related violence in the PNG Highlands.
My view is that it may be even getting worse. Now, that could be because we're discovering more and they're hiding it less, you know, so it maybe it's the same amount, but it's coming more to our attention. But my impression is it's getting worse rather than better.
Well, it seems the bishop's fears have been realized because the latest reports from non-government organizations on the ground in Papua New Guinea suggest such attacks are occurring on a near daily basis. Estimates put the number of sorcery accusation-related deaths at 700 or more every year. But Gary Bustin, founder of the PNG Tribal Foundation, which supports attacked survivors, says very few cases ever hit the headlines.
Just yesterday, we had a man who was burned to death in his hut who was accused of sorcery. And then also, we had a woman who committed suicide last week who was accused of sorcery by her husband. And instead of being tortured, she went ahead and hung herself. And then we had a 70-year-old man in Jawaka who was killed and his genitals were cut off and placed in his mouth. So this is ongoing. What happens is when there's a video, then it goes viral and then people get all upset about that. But in reality, we're dealing with cases happening at least every other day, if not every day. And oftentimes there isn't video, and so there isn't the public outcry that there should be.
It's extremely disturbing stuff, and I do apologize to our listeners for having to learn about how brutal sorcery violence is in Papua New Guinea, but there really isn't a polite way to describe it. Why? It seems the motive goes beyond just killing an alleged sorcerer, right? Why? What's behind the torture and the mutilation?
There's two reasons. One of them is, unfortunately, for sport. And there's a sort of a sadistic pleasure that they get out of it. So a lot of times, especially the women, they heat hot iron and they put it into their genitals and cook them from the inside out. So this is a sadistic pleasure that they get from it. And the second reason is because there's kind of folklore that these sorcerers are stealing hearts, and that's why someone in the community dies, because a sorcerer stole their heart. And so they say if they torture them enough, then they can put the heart back in the person and the person will live. There are a lot of stories that are made up by people who know that they're dealing with mostly uneducated people and that they need to trick enough of the people. So there's always some sort of a gimmick involved in how these glass men or glass Mary are able to see spiritual things. So they'll come up with different things. One lady had a bumblebee, a pet bumblebee that she said would tell her, you know, who was the sorcerer. Another woman, she said that Mary, the mother of Jesus, came to her when she was 12 and taught her how to pray and see who the sorcerers are. Basically, they prey on ignorance. They use fear and confusion and deception to get someone accused. So it's a very complex issue. It's not straightforward. Usually there's someone involved who's got a motive and something to gain, almost every case.
How's the government responding to this? Are they doing enough?
No. The government is mostly talking and having forums and doing awareness. And the government needs to get behind the prosecutions, like I'm saying. If we have this problem that's on a rise and it's been going for a long time, and we've been talking about it and holding forums and doing awareness, and the problem's on the rise, then we have to stop and look and go, is what we're doing working? Shall we do more of the same thing, or shall we do something different? And I'm telling you as a leading expert on this issue that we can't just keep talking. It doesn't make a difference, obviously, because we're seeing more and more cases, and there's been plenty of money poured into talking, bringing people into fancy hotels, having talks. And I often say that Glassmen don't go to forums. So you have to roll your sleeves up. You have to go into the places where these people are, and you have to work with the police to get them arrested. And then the prosecution process is very long and arduous. It takes 2 to 3 years for a successful prosecution. That means that we have to look after the victims for at least 2 to 3 years because their lives are in danger. We also have to work against corrupt police officers. The whole system is broken down. So if the government, if you ask me if the government is doing enough, the answer is absolutely not. The reason why it's on the rise is because no one has been prosecuting. So the only way this is going to stop is to prosecute those people involved in it. The only thing that's going to stop it is successful prosecutions and people spending time behind bars, and then awareness saying, this guy is in jail for 10, 15, 20 years because he was involved in killing this innocent person. And if you do that, the same thing will happen to you.
Gary Bustin, founder of the PNG Tribal Foundation, at the forefront of the battle to stamp out sorcery accusation-related violence. And he was talking to Finau Funua. To Tonga, where a new bridge project designed to connect the eastern side to Nuku'alofa and bring Tonga closer together is instead creating division in the community. While it's being celebrated by some, others are asking why it's taking so long and at what cost. Marianne Kupu in Nuku'alofa reports.
I'm standing here in the village of Ma'ufanga, a quiet place, right near the edge of the Fulaha Lagoon, where birdsong and only the occasional passing bicycle break the silence. But the noises of nature, some say, may soon be replaced by something else.
For me, I don't approve of this.
Luisa V lives in Umusi at Ma'ufanga, just steps away from where the proposed new bridge project for Tonga is set to land.
The reason being, Marianne, is that we'll have people coming in and out that we don't know. There'll be vehicles we're unfamiliar with, and not knowing if they're genuinely passing by or for something else, I won't feel safe.
The bridge is planned to stretch over Fulaha Lagoon, linking the eastern community to central Nuku'alofa. Backed by the Asian Development Bank, it's been called a key development project, one that could reduce travel time and ease traffic on Taufa'aha Road. But community voices are mixed. For some, the bridge brings long-awaited relief. For others, it raises concern about privacy, security, and way of life. But Vitolia Ngolea, who lives on the eastern side, is not convinced of its benefits and thinks there will be more congestion with the bridge.
Right now, all the traffic pressure falls on a single route into Nuku'alofa, Taufa'aho Road. But if the bridge is built, it would create an additional entry point into town, easing congestion while providing an alternative route. Instead of relying on just one main road, we'd have multiple access ways into the capital.
And then there's the cost. Initial estimates of $45 million 10 years ago have now risen to an estimated $115 million. The Asian Development Bank has approved around $80 million for the project. Former officials say meeting 35 million gap has delayed progress, with coal funding arrangements proving difficult to navigate. The Asian Development Bank has been contacted for comment. Despite this, Tonga's government flagged at a press conference last month that the project will start in August. It failed to respond to the ABC's request for comment. Former Minister for Infrastructure, 17 Domo'ua, told ABC the bridge has always been a top priority, but uncontrollable cost surges and procedural hurdles have delayed actions, and he's not convinced the government will be able to stick by its timeline.
It will take time for the government to go back to ADB to fund this financial gap. But we have to go through their own policies. It takes time. For the actual construction, you need at least 3 months to 6 months mobilization. Yeah, we have to sign a contract. We have to get the contractors from New Zealand. We have to get their office, everything, get everything from overseas.
Back on the ground, landowners like Netta says they've been left in the dark while initially approached years ago. They say there's been no formal consultation or compensation to date.
So we were approached that they will take some piece of our land to make the road, the main road. That was the conversation a few years ago. But within today, nothing has been told or being talked about the latest. So it bothers with our building and also the construction and everything at home due to that conversation of taking our piece of land.
In Umusi village, Luisa says they'll be watching closely.
For the safety of my family, I wish the government can reconsider their decision because I don't want the bridge to be built.
Malfanga villager Luisa V ending Marian Kupu's report. Stick around because up next we'll take a look at the headlines from around the region with Kyle Evans.
In the Fale is a music show on ABC Radio Australia, hosted by me, Paola Tukefu. I'll be spinning my favourite tunes from dancehall to disco, calypso to country, reggae to roots, and hip-hop to house music, from across the eras to keep the kids and the aunties happy. If it has a pumping groove, I'll be bringing it to you to bump you into the weekend.
In the Fale, Friday afternoons at 3 PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Kick off your Sunday with Kuntamari Crofts on Pacific Sundays, right here on ABC Radio Australia. Pacific Sundays is a laid-back weekly wrap of all things Pacific, from news, sport, and entertainment to the best island music vibes. So whether you're chilling out, heading off to church, or catching up with family, be entertained as you do it with Pacific Sundays. Every Sunday at 6 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. No Pacific island has felt the effects of climate change more keenly than Hawaii in recent years, after a series of wildfires broke out in early August of 2023. The wind-driven fires killed more than 100 people and caused widespread devastation, predominantly on the island of Maui. Despite the damage, securing funding to protect against these events has become even harder under U.S. President Donald Trump, whose skepticism for climate change is well known. But a new tourist tax set to be imposed in 2026 will help culminate that, with Hawaii's Governor Josh Green telling Carl Evans the levy paid by visitors will allow the state to defend against natural disasters without federal support.
I actually proposed this when I first became governor and President Biden was still president. So we came into office in 2022, my team and I, and I proposed it right then, actually even before the fire. So we felt, after many years as a senator and a representative, I felt that we needed to have this kind of capacity. We usually don't have enough money to help our Department of Land and Natural Resources. We've always been underfunded. And climate change has only made things worse and more complicated and challenging for us as state governors. So I knew it was the right thing to do. It took a couple years to convince my legislature to pass it. And then the wildfire kind of sealed the deal because they saw how truly impactful climate change was. Now, of course, with the current administration making some cuts to environmental protection and, you know, kind of leaning into fossil fuels more, we're mindful that the impact of climate change could be greater.
Yeah, I've spoken to representatives in other U.S. territories, such as Guam, who I guess expressed a similar sentiment in the sense that since Trump came to power, climate change is no longer a approved language. And if you want to secure funding for climate resilience, you sort of got to go about it in other ways, I guess. And is that something that you have found as well?
I'd say that's fairly accurate. I think I have had conversations, you know, directly with cabinet level members and, you know, direct supporters and top officials with the president's team. And they, you know, they've said that they'll work on projects with us, but climate related projects are not really their focus. So I'm balancing what I do with what the federal government's, you know, ideology is. And that way I keep my state, you know, healthy, and there's room to, you know, there's room for the state governments to complement what the federal government does. Obviously, I have some differences of opinion with the administration on, say, taxes or immigration, but I do agree in some cases that, you know, we have to, you know, kind of come together and work together. And this was my way to show that we could step up.
Now, let's talk about the tax. I know it's going to apply to hotels, short-term rentals, cruise ships. So how much more will tourists expect to pay?
It'll be very negligible. So let's say someone was planning a significant trip and they were going to spend $4,000 here. They would pay $30 more. So it's, you know, it's way less than even one day of a fee that you might pay at a hotel for parking. It's very minimal, but when you have 10 million people coming and you have 0.75% added, you know, like less than 1% just on those bills that are hotels, short-term rentals, and cruise stays when people are in port, people are barely going to notice it, but it adds up for us. And also, for every $5 million that comes in that I, you know, use to generate bonds, which we pay, I can have $100 million in projects. And so for each, you know, for each $400 a person spends, they'll pay an extra $3. And their dollars will go directly to making the experience even better because they'll see that the beach is going to be restored in lots of places where there's been erosion, or we'll be able to put up better trails that have been windblown because of, you know, heavy storms, things like that.
Are there any particular big projects that you're working towards, which you hope this money will fund?
Yes, we definitely want to fund all of the necessary protections against wildfires and hurricanes. That's a big deal for us, just to be very safe. So that's a large part of it. We've already established a new department run by a fire marshal, so it's very helpful for us. I mentioned earlier that we have to make sure, as we have a lot more people here, that waste that runs off into the ocean doesn't affect, you know, the reef and doesn't affect the beaches. And so we're in the process, a long process over the next 20 plus years to remediate those challenges. That takes a lot of money, you'd be surprised. So that's going to be helpful. But there's also a lot of nonprofits that are going to be doing work, like, for instance, planting native species of plants, which helps with runoff. It protects our water and it helps us to build housing because we need to keep that water here. It helps us to have hotels because we need the water for the hotels. So there are a lot of projects that normally it was difficult to get a legislator to fund. Having been a member of the House and the Senate over the years, I know that. So people will really be helping us.
Do you think this policy or policies like this is something that could be implemented by other U.S. territories like Guam or even the COFA states?
It won't surprise me if this does catch on because you see what's happening when hurricanes or floods hit different, you know, states. They just don't have enough resources to recover. And it's going to be difficult in the current administration to get enough resources from FEMA or out of the Congress just because there's a little bit of tension, if I can be nice about it.
What's it like being a Democratic governor with, you know, under a Republican administration?
Well, a lot of people think of me as a physician governor under Trump or under Biden. I've tended to demur the political labels just because it gets everyone into hot water. But it's okay. You know, I have a job to do. I just pretty much care for my constituents like I'm their doctor. And we get along fine. I have had some interesting encounters with the president. He did share with me that as long as I didn't call him out by name, we'd be okay. And I do speak up, you know, about some of his cabinet members because I have concerns about what the Department of Health and Human Services is doing on vaccinations. I was working side by side with Australian doctors and nurses when there was the outbreak of measles in the region. You know, I personally went as part of a medical mission. So I'm just going to speak up.
Hawaii's Governor Josh Green speaking with Kyle Evans.
Hold the front page!
Welcome back to Pacific Beat. I'm Belinda Cora, and we are going to take a quick trip around the region now to what's making headlines. And to do that, I'm joined by producer Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle. How are you?
Good morning, Belinda. I'm very well. I actually just realized this is the first time we've spoken since the state of origin. You've told me in the past you're a big Queensland supporter. I'm sure that must have been a good night for you.
Oh, definitely. It was really loud here in Port Moresby, so I'm hoping that our Blues supporters are actually keen to look forward to next year. They were pretty worried about that.
Well, as one of those Blues supporters, let's just never speak of this again. How about that?
New Caledonia's politicians will employ police protection following death threats. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
I can indeed, Belinda. So those who inked their signature on that deal with France back on July 12, they're going to be offered special police protection after they received death threats on social media from certain people who are unhappy with the terms. So almost 20 members of New Caledonia's parties who put their names to it will be offered this measure, and they come from both pro-France and pro-independence groups. And it comes after members from both parties were targeted by a wide range of reactions from their bases, some of which came before the deal was even signed. Some of those reactions have included thinly veiled death threats. Some members have even been labelled traitors. And I suppose, you know, this deal was always bound to be controversial given it represents a commitment to New Caledonia's political future. Therefore, concessions were always going to have to be made on both sides. So it's understandable in some ways that some people were going to get upset. And just as a result of that, those concessions, as one of them included a commitment to abandon the full demand for sovereignty, at least for now. But on the flip side, it also promises to make New Caledonia a state within the French realm, as well as recognize it as its own nationality.
Thanks, Kyle. And speaking of France, they've committed €18 million to build a submarine cable between New Caledonia and Vanuatu.
That's right. It's a world first, according to the Vanuatu Daily Post. It's a science monitoring and reliable telecommunications cable, otherwise known as a smart cable, which will connect the two Pacific neighbours with this smart technology. And the French ambassador to Vanuatu announced the commitment during Bastille Day celebrations in Port Vila recently. It will do a number of things, particularly in relation to monitoring climate change. It will be equipped with sensors to measure sea temperature and seismic activity, allowing it to provide early warnings for things like tsunamis. It will also improve just general digital connectivity, as well as just with data collection, going to a secure data center in New Caledonia where it will be accessible to scientists, civil protection agencies, firms like that.
And when will it come online?
It's a great question. So 2026 is when it will all get underway. So, very much looking forward to seeing how that pans out.
And lastly, to top it off, for the PNG Hunters in Rugby League Queensland Cup, who are they facing?
Yeah, it's a huge game for them this weekend. So they'll be taking on the Ipswich Jets in Port Moresby. It's a must-win game in a lot of ways, given it's a real chance to get their season back on track, which has unfortunately fallen off the rails in recent weeks. They've lost four out of their last five games, three of which have been losses by pretty big margins. They currently sit 10th on the ladder, a game outside of the top eight where they've spent most of the season. And with only five games left, they are kind of running out of time now to turn things around. I suppose the good news is they do know what's at stake. They've brought back veteran Brendan Nema for this game, who will re-enter the side. Unfortunately, fullback Sonny Wabo, he's come out after getting injured last week against the Capras, so he'll probably be replaced by youngster Douglas David, who will fill that gap at fullback in what's going to be his second game for the Hunters.
Thanks, Kyle, for those headlines, and I hope to probably see you in Port Moresby to watch the Hunters anytime soon.
Oh, if not the Hunters, I certainly hope to be there for round one of that NRL game in 2028, but we'll see.
Producer Kyle Evans bringing us our news wrap.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music for the finest in ska, rocksteady, roots, dub, sizzling dancehall, and all the hottest releases from around the Pacific.
Hi, I'm Ronnie Coreni from Sorong Samurai, and you're listening to Island Music.
My name is Tieni from Te Tangi o Te Kara, and you're listening to Island Music.
Join me, Rick Howe, on Island Music.
Saturdays, 12 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
In Vanuatu, recent criticism of non-government organisations such as Oxfam is leaving many worried about their futures. One NGO based in a remote community just outside of Port Vila is using sewing to help young girls who have dropped out of school. But beyond fabric and thread, there's a bigger story about the role of these types of organizations and the tensions they sometimes encounter. The ABC reporter in Port Vila, Lily Rose Wellwell, has the story.
In a small room inside a two-story house at Sumalava, sewing machines whir loudly with hopeful chatter. For 15 girls, some as young as 13 years old, the sewing club offers more than just skills building. As project manager Esther Pelton says, it provides a second chance.
So as we looked in our community, we saw young girls just staying in the house, playing card, doing 20 watu, and just telling stories and go to the sea and fish all day. So we decided that we want to help them. And a few of them are still scared. They told me that they can't sew because they've never sewn. I said, that's where we want to start, with girls who never sewed, and give them the opportunity to learn, and they can also upskill them to sew and sell and get some money.
Foundation One Vanuatu's Showing Initiative, a community-driven effort held in the founder's home, is not a formal training. It is funded through small grants and founders' resources. Kim Jones is the country director.
You can give people money and you've got them, give them food for a day or a week, but if you give them job skills, then they can generate their own employment, generate their own money, and they can feed themselves.
The sewing program is an example of a proto pattern in Vanuatu, where grassroots organizations quietly fill development gaps. But the non-government sector has recently faced pressure. It all came after Oxfam Vanuatu, a well-known name in the region, falsely accused the government of changing the renewable energy laws. The government publicly called out the organization, and Oxfam Vanuatu admitted it made a mistake. The government has since threatened some NGOs with deregistration, and online platforms have since accused some NGOs of political or foreign influence.
There are an increased number of community-based organizations now that are currently affected
of maybe not even receiving the service delivery from the government.
That was Shelley Abram, the CEO of the Umbrella Party of NGOs in Vanuatu. She says over 80% of its 200 members are local grassroots organizations, and the accusation eating NGOs is a misrepresentation.
They're in the disadvantaged communities where they're tired and they wanted to raise their voices on talking to the government about how can service delivery come to us. And for an NGO, maybe there's some misinformation, disinformation only. Could be, you know, whatever the stand for the government is. For us, is you can correct that, but you cannot silence an NGO to stand up for the community or represent the community. So this is our stand as Vango.
She says from youth empowerment to climate change and health outreach, NGOs in Vanuatu have played a vital role in development, often in remote areas beyond the government's reach. But the Minister of Internal Affairs, Andrew Napwat, says while NGOs are playing an important role, they must operate within clear boundaries set by the government. Mr. Napwat says he agrees that NGOs have a critical role in the country, but they also have responsibilities.
We must respect them.
They must respect NGO guidelines that government has placed. And secondly, they should not promote anything that is contrary to the values of the people too. Like not overstepping their boundaries. That's right. They should not involve in national issues or matters that concern the national sovereignty. And they should work within their scope of work only. And they are not here to challenge the government. They are here to work with the government or complement the work of the government.
Stephen Noel, the executive director of a local youth challenge Vanuatu that trains marginalized youth with career and entrepreneurial skills. He says they too get some support from the government, but not directly. And he says they are struggling financially.
Government is not directly supporting us, but they recognize the local NGOs like us and they recognize what we are doing, but it's very difficult for them to directly funding our programs, and that's one of the most challenges that we are facing at the moment, and we have to look for funding. That's why we have to build a network and partnership with other local international NGOs and local NGOs that are based in Vanuatu.
According to Esther Pelton, despite the politics, it's all about giving back and to sow seeds of real change and transforming communities with what they have.
Many of us are not rich. We also are struggling with our family, but we know what we are doing because we live with people. We have nothing, and we are working from scraps.
Esther Belton from Foundation One Vanuatu, ending that report from Lily Rose Wellwell. Welcome back to Pacific Beat. Turning to sport now. There could be history in the making in Suva tomorrow when Papua New Guinea takes on Solomon Islands in the OFC Women's Nation Cup final. PNG has dominated women's soccer in the islands for years, and it would be no surprise if they were to regain the title they first won on the same ground 3 years ago. But after losing their opening match of the tournament to the host nation Fiji, Solomon Islands have gone from strength to strength, led by their inspirational captain Eileen Peggy. So could there be a new name etched on the OFC Nations Cup tomorrow night? The match will be shown live and free on FIFA Plus, and we're joined online from Suva now by one of the half the TV commentary team, Satish Naren. Welcome to Pacific Beat.
Ula Venaka from Fiji.
Bula. Let's start with the champions, PNG. Have they got their mojo back after a slowish start to the tournament?
I think Papua New Guinea is the team to beat, knowing that they've got a very formidable side, packed with the champion Hekari Women's FC team that played in the recent OFC Women's Champions League in Tahiti. So, you know, and they are the only undefeated side, with the captain Ramona Padio and joint top goal scorer at the moment, Mari Kaipu. She's on target. She's scored in every match, just missed out in the semi-final. They are looking good, and they should be the team to beat.
What is it that makes PNG so hard to beat? No island team has ever got the better of them in the competition.
Oh, I think Papua New Guinea, they are very big as far as women's football goes. They are playing in the 11th tournament of the OFC Women's Nations Cup. You know, more than 50% than any other nation that is competing. So they've been in the game for a while. They've got a very good setup in Papua New Guinea. They sort of fizzled away a little bit, but they're back in. Fiji beat them in the 2018 Women's Nations Cup semi-final, 5-1. But, you know, Papua New Guinea have recovered. Papua New Guinea are back on track, and you know, they are going. They are looking to create history. First island nation trying to win back-to-back Nations Cup tournament.
For Solomon Islands, history begins. But are they good enough to beat Papua New Guinea this time around?
I think what the Solomon Islands will bring against Papua New Guinea is physicality. That's what Fiji couldn't bring against Papua New Guinea. That's what the other teams in the group stage couldn't do against Papua New Guinea. But the Solomon Islands play sort of a similar style of football when you compare it with Papua New Guinea. And that physicality will be there from the Solomon Islands. And they got, like you mentioned, Eileen Peggy. You know, she is a pocket rocket. She is so good around the field, and she links up with her teammates so well. She is an inspiration for the Solomon Islands. And then they got players like Madeline Arukau and Lorena Solosaya and Alma Gogoni. You know, they are some big names and who have been playing some good football over the last 10, 12 days. So if they play, if they turn up to play, and if they can bring their football brains into action with a little bit of physicality, they have all the chance against Papua New Guinea. This is the final, you know, and they will be going all out to, you know, do the unthinkable, I think.
Indeed, their captain, Eileen Peggy, was the first female player from the Solomons to be given a professional contract in New Caledonia, in fact. How highly do you rate her?
I think she is very good. You know, just nippy around the field. You know, just the football IQ that she has is top notch. You know, she knows when to run into spaces, and you know, as a forward line player, as a striker, she needs to anticipate those kind of things. She anticipates what the defender will do, a move ahead, and things like that. So her football IQ is quite you know, like top-notch, and I rate her very highly. She's in my book, you know, she would be in the top three to win the Golden Ball or the player of the tournament title.
So if Peggy is on song, the chances of a Solomon's win would appear to be that much greater?
You're right. You know, in sport, if you have a player that you know, is rated quite high, you know, is a big star in the team, and if they turn up on the day of the game and they're 100% and they're playing very well, and you know, they just lift the others around them. So the same would happen on the other side for Papua New Guinea. If their captain Padio and goal scorer Kaipu, they turn up on the day, and you know, they are really good, you know, the players around them will also lift. But for Peggy, I think she is the only one in the Solomon Islands team that can lift everyone around her. She has that mana in her game. She has that spirit. She's always smiling, but you know, like, she's hard when it comes to the game game time, and she executes things very well. So I think Peggy will be the game breaker for Solomon Islands.
Would a Solomon's win be a good thing for the development of women's soccer across Oceania by showing the other nations that PNG are not invincible?
You just nailed it. I think that is something that I was going to use in the commentary tomorrow. That you know, Solomon Islands have got more than a final to play. I think they can show to the rest of the Oceania nations that you know, if you put your heart and soul and you know, everything into good preparation, and you have a good structure and you have good coaching coaching staff and the players can stand up. Any team can beat Papua New Guinea on the day, and the Solomon Islands have a big chance to do that tomorrow. Mind you, no team has beaten the Papua New Guinea in this tournament. So the Solomon Islands have their work cut out tomorrow. But yes, if they win, that'll be great for football in the region.
And Satish, which team is your pick to win this weekend?
That's a tough question. That's really tough. You know, like I've been asked this same question. Like I've been around town yesterday and early this morning, I met a couple of people and they are all asking, "Oh, big final tomorrow. You know, who are you picking?" And it's a tough question. You know, my heart wants the Solomon Islands to win because that'll be good for football. That will be good for women's football, for the growth of the game in the Solomon Islands and in other countries like Vanuatu, the Melanesian countries, Vanuatu, Fiji, and even the smaller countries can take heart out of that. But PNG will be very tough to beat. They've got a very good coach in Erickson Komeng. They have a very balanced, well-balanced side from the goalkeeper to Mari Kaipu up front. I think one of the best sides that I've seen in a while in women's football. So that will be tough to beat. So, you know, my heart wants Solomon's to win, but, you know, Papua New Guinea will be very tough to beat.
Satish Naren, the voice of rugby in Fiji, but right now the voice of the OFC Women's Nation Cup as well. And he'll be on the mic with co-commentator Asinata Wainingolo for the big game tomorrow night. That's PNG taking on Solomon Islands.
Want to catch up or listen again to your favourite ABC Radio Australia programs anytime, anywhere? From Pacific Beat to Stories from the Pacific, Nisian Footy to Culture Compass. You can listen to your top shows on your favourite podcast app on the go and for free. Just search for your favourite ABC Radio Australia program in your podcast app and press play. ABC Radio Australia, bringing you more ways to listen.
To rugby now, Manu Samoa will take to the field at their home away from home in Auckland this evening to play Scotland, with former team captain Tusi Pisi taking the reins as head coach. It'll be Samoa's first match for quite some time after they bailed out of their traditional Northern Hemisphere tour last November because their rugby union couldn't afford to send them to Europe. However, as Richard Irwitt reports, when it came to picking a squad to face the Scots, the new setup has already encountered some old problems.
They've got numbers here. Fainlevi with his pace and his strength. And Moana Pasifika go bang, bang. Two quick scores to start the second half.
Yeah, Miracle Fainlevi, we were hoping, you know, he'd be the poster boy for Samoa rugby, as he should have been. The cynic in me wonders if there's bigger things that play around that in terms of not being available for Samoa anymore.
It's a familiar story for the Pacific Nations, star names who for one reason or another can't or choose not to play for their countries of heritage. Ramsay Tomokino has struggled with the problem for years as a coach, and now it's landed on his plate in his new role as Lakapi Samoa's head of high performance. Failangi's decision to opt out came as a surprise, bearing in mind he is the only Samoa developed player in the Moana Pacifica squad. However, the word around New Zealand right now is that some Pacifica Super Rugby players on the Kiwi team's books are being warned off contractually from playing for the island nations, but Tomokino isn't convinced.
It's a bit of a myth, actually. So there's a regulation, Regulation 9, which protects everybody, protects your club, protects the player, protects the international game. What that means is if you're a contracted player and you're selected to represent your country, you cannot be disincentivized and you're released for 5 days for international duty. If you're not required in the 23, you get released back to your club. And so that protects the player. They can't be cut from their contract.
Regardless of the whys and wherefores, the Manu have a game to play, and coach Tusi PC has a squad that includes some notable new names. Jacob Omanga is one of three debutants, having been picked to play for England on one occasion 4 years ago before being cast aside. Now he lines up for the team that his father Mike graced, and under the watchful eye, no doubt, of his uncle, Moana Pacifica's head coach and former All Blacks skipper Tana Umanga. And among the players on the bench will be Nico Jones, son of all-time All Blacks great and former Manu coach Michael Jones. These are the players the new coach hopes will take the team to the 2027 World Cup, and he says they'll be given every chance to state their case.
My stance on it, and I made it really clear, whoever is here and puts their best foot forward and performs well, then we've got to consider their player. That's also my coach's stance on that. So the players that are here have a great opportunity.
So in essence, you're inviting particularly the new players to go out there and make a name for themselves.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
We had players saying, we're available for Scotland, we're available for Northern Hemisphere Tour, but we're not available for the PNC, which is the World Cup qualification, which to me is their highest priority for us. And we want to seal the deal this year and knowing that we're going to the Rugby World Cup through this process. The discussion that I drove was, if you're not available for PNC, you know, you lose the privilege to play against Scotland to represent Samoa against a Tier 1 team.
The game against the Scots is being staged at Eden Park because right now there is no home ground available for the Manu back in Samoa. And with an election pending in the islands, it's unclear how that problem will be resolved and who will pay for renovating Apia Park or building a brand new stadium. But in the meantime, the plan is to tap into the Samoan diaspora in Oceania and maybe even further afield.
At this stage, you know, our home games are potentially going to be here in Australia. And yeah, it's probably not a bad thing either because, you know, we can go to the west of Sydney, where I'm sure we'll have a strong following there. And then obviously take our games around New Zealand as well, potentially. And hopefully, you know, some backers listening and wants to take a game to the States.
It's a great opportunity for Manu Samoa to take the games to those countries. Yes, it's unfortunate that we're not able to play in our home nation, but the population of Samoans in New Zealand and Australia in America, you know, there's a lot. So it's also a exciting time for those that are in those countries to see Manu Samoa. And I think on the back of Moana's performances and how well they did this year, I'm hoping for a big crowd.
After going down 29-14 to the Flying Fijians in Suva, the Scots have made 8 changes to their team, a clear indication you would think that they don't intend to suffer back-to-back defeats in the Pacific. But Tusipisi paid close attention to Fiji's winning strategy, and he's confident that Samoa can learn from that and enhance their own chances of toppling Scotland for just the second time in their history.
We're always happy for our neighbours when we watch them play, and I guess for us it's just taking the learnings from their game and seeing what opportunities that Fiji explored in Scotland with and utilising it. We're celebrating the players that are here and that have made themselves available. We're really impressed with their application and their professionalism. And whoever dons that blue jersey, they're the best players in Samoa.
And as the kickoff approaches, is the man at the helm of the Manu for the very first time facing more pressure or less than he did during his playing days when he made 42 appearances in the blue of Samoa?
No, I don't think it's under pressure. I think it's just the nerves of just being excited about what this group can do, and also excited about just seeing the preparation, the hard work the players have put in, and just celebrating that on Friday night.
To CPC, who will make his debut at Manu's head coach tonight when his team takes on the Scots at Eden Park in Auckland with a kickoff at 7:35 p.m. local time. So that's 8:35 in Samoa. And the reporter there was Richard Irwitt. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time Monday morning. That's 6 a.m. PNG time. You can also hear us again this afternoon at 5 p.m. PNG time. That will be with Eggy Tupo. Stay tuned to ABC Radio Australia because news is next. And coming up, that is Nija Daily. This is Belinda Cora from ABC House in Port Moresby. Have a great day.
Melissa Macon for Nija Daily, the afternoon edition, every Tuesday and Wednesday on ABC Radio Australia. I'll bring you the stories of the week from across the Pacific and talk health and religion with experts in their field and individuals making a difference.
Search up ABC Nija Daily afternoon edition to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.